For the week of October 14th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 167, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at Yankee Stadium in sackcloth and ashes, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, Michael, I'm sorry to hear about the Yankees, but once again, it is time for Showbiz Sandbox. This is the show where we bring together some, entertainment industry pundits, and we tell all of our listeners about the week's worth of entertainment headlines.
So lift me out of my depression. What are we going to talk about today?
Okay, well, last week, the venerable trade paper Variety, which has been covering the entertainment industry for more than 100 years, it was sold to Penske Media Company for $25 million. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's because Penske Media Company, or PMC, also owns Deadline, and they own Movie Line and Hollywood Life and a number of other properties. We're going to be speaking with Dana Harris a little later on. She's the editor-in-chief of IndieWire, who spent 11 years at Variety, and she wrote an interesting editorial about the sale and what it all really means to the industry and to, I guess, publishing, really. Surely something that was reported in Variety, though we wouldn't know since they're behind a paywall, is the news about how much money the digital radio company Pandora is paying out to artists as they fight to make artist payments more, quote-unquote, what they call fair, their words, not ours. Pandora made public last week that they pay some artists as much as $3 million. I don't think either Michael or I fall into that category. And if you think the fights that on-screen superheroes get into can be tough, you should see some of the legal battles that their creators take on. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. That is, if he has recovered from his New York Yankees losses in the baseball playoffs this weekend.
All right, so when I wasn't going to baseball, I was not going to the movies. I was too busy. But the number one movie around the world is Taken 2, which grossed $63 million. The Liam Neeson action film has now made $220 million around the world. At number two is Hotel Transylvania, the animated film starring the voice of Adam Sandler. That grossed $31 million worldwide. It's at $151 million and counting. At number three is Argo, the Ben Affleck film, which did a good circuit of the award festival season and has now opened strongly in North America. It grossed $20 million in its debut weekend and had excellent reviews and an A-plus cinema score, which means everyone who saw it liked it. And that was certainly the reaction I got from people that I spoke to this week.
And I would imagine all those people were in the bleachers at Yankee Stadium.
They were, actually.
And I saw the film. It's a very good film. As you say, it made the rounds, the festival rounds of, I want to say, Telluride in Toronto. I don't know whether it was in Venice, but it's a very good film. And as I was watching the first, at the very beginning of the film, there's the Warner Brothers logo, and it's the 1979-1980 Warner Brothers logo. And it had all these film scratches, and I'm looking at it knowing that this is a digital presentation and going, wow, I forgot how grainy and scratchy film was.
Well, it's I think it'll be a serious contender for the Oscars.
Yeah, it's a film well worth seeing. It gets a little Hollywood-y toward the end, but I enjoyed it.
At number four, basically opening in North America only, is Sinister, a horror film starring one of my favorite actors, Ethan Hawke. It grossed $18 million, and that's from Summit. They say the movie cost $3 million to make, which sounds very small given that Ethan Hawke stars in it. But wow, if you make six times your budget on opening weekend, you've done a good job.
Especially if you report that you only spent $3 million on it.
Yeah. At number five is Looper, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis action sci-fi movie. Another $15 million. It's at $110 million and counting. And number six is Ted, which I just received on Blu-ray. I'm looking forward to checking that out. It grossed $14 million. It's now at $469 million worldwide, making it the highest grossing R-rated comedy of all time.
Now I've got to warn you, Michael. I know it's got a teddy bear on the cover of that Blu-ray.
Yeah,
but there may be a few, well, foul-mouthed, profane words along the way. I just want to warn you.
So keep the kiddies away.
Yes.
And number seven is a film that opened in Spain. It may have had, they're not clear yet, but it may have had the highest opening weekend of all time in Spain. It's The Impossible, but it's not technically a Spanish film or in Spanish. It stars Ewan McGregor and Naomi Watts. It's about a family surviving a tsunami. And it was a huge opening there, and it's opening here in North America in a few weeks, so it'll be interesting to see how it does.
Did you just say Ewan McGregor's name with a Scottish accent?
I just said the name the way it's supposed to be said. What do you mean?
Okay, just checking.
I say Jean Belmondo, not Jean.
Oh, okay.
At number 8 is Frankenweenie, the Tim Burton animated film, stop motion to be specific, another $12 million. It's at $27 million and counting. At number 9, opening only in North America, also at $12 million, is Here Comes the Boom, the Kevin James comedy about a high school teacher who takes up mixed martial arts so he can save extracurricular activities, you know, band and art class and all that sort of stuff. It happens all the time. At number 10 is Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted, another $10 million. That's at $681 million and counting. And number 11 is Pitch Perfect, which I thought they might have opened a little too wide last weekend, but it made another $9 million and it had a good hold. It dropped only 37%. It's now at $37 million and counting, which for a film that cost $17 million to make is good news. And number 12 is Resident Evil Retribution, another $5 million for that horror franchise. And at number 13 is Seven Psychopaths, a film by Martin McDonagh, the playwright. It's from CBS Films. It only made $4 million, but it did get some good reviews. I know people who loved In Bruges or In Bruges, however you say that.
In Bruges.
In Bruges, thank you. Another film directed by Martin McDonagh and starring Colin Farrell. He's used Colin Farrell again in this film. It's sort of a crime comedy film. And, you know, he's determined to prove that Colin Farrell can act. And he's doing it.
That's fairly mean. I mean, we've seen Colin Farrell act in a couple of films.
Right, but, you know, he uses him. Colin Farrell hasn't gotten a lot of good work. He had another shot at a franchise, and that film collapsed. So, you know, he must be Martin. He probably is sending Martin McDonagh Christmas cards, I would imagine.
Birthday
possibly. Greetings.
I bet you're right, yeah.
In limited release, we had The Perks of Being a Wallflower. That did a very smart expansion. It grew by 500 screens to 700 total. It made a sort of a lowish 3,000 per screen average, but it broke into the top 10. It made $2 million. It's now at $6 million and counting. And so I think they've done a good job of positioning it, building word of mouth, not opening it too wide, and breaking into the top 10 and hopefully getting on more and more people's radars as they try and build word of mouth about this small film.
I'll tell you, every other commercial that I see on, I guess it's Comedy Central, seems to be for this particular film.
Yeah, I know exactly. Going through the Daily Show, when I speed through the commercials, I've been seeing that ad too. And also in limited release is Atlas, not limited release, I shouldn't say that at all. Atlas Shrugged Part 2, the second part of a film adaptation of the novel by Ayn Rand. It grossed $1.7 million on 1,000 screens. It's very much been pitched to libertarian and white right-wing groups. They've basically said, if you don't like Obama, come see this film. Show your support for this film. So if you want to take this as a political harbinger of the election, then it's a good news for Barack Obama.
You didn't see the first one. Now come and not see the second one. Atlas Shrugged Part 2.
It's a hard pitch to make.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Coming up this weekend will be Tyler Perry opening in Alex Cross. He's taking over the role of that detective from Morgan Freeman. The horror film Paranormal Activity 4, getting a jump on the Halloween season. And the Oscar bait film The Sessions, starring Helen Hunt and John Hawks.
And The Sessions was up in Sundance. It was a good film. It's well worth seeing.
Yes, I'm sorry I missed the screening for it. Postseason baseball got in the way. I had a screening at the Paris Theater, one of my favorite theaters in Manhattan. So I'm looking forward to checking it out.
I'll tell you, this baseball is really affecting your life. I'm gonna
It really is.
Get me George Steinbrenner. I need to talk to him about this.
Yeah, so I'm glad that, you know,
you see, the joke there was that George Steinbrenner's not around.
Oh, I got it.
Okay. You can laugh later.
I'm glad that baseball ends in the end of October, beginning of November, because that means any films coming out in November will be open for me. I'll be able to see them. I won't be confused and distracted.
Well, let me ask you this then. If that's the case, do you have plans for November, not this year, and in fact, not next year or the year after that, but November of 2015?
Not yet. Though, presumably, if they keep adding rounds to the postseason, baseball could stretch to November 15th, but I doubt it.
Well, let me make some plans with you to go see a film based on Peanuts. You know, the comic strip that Charles Schulz did for well over 50 years, I think. Apparently, it's going to be turned into a film and released in November of 2015.
Well, and it wouldn't be the first film based on Peanuts. They've done Snoopy Come Home and some other Charlie Brown movies, though he's best known, of course, for the TV adaptations, which have been mainstays for decades and some of the most popular TV specials of all time.
Well, I mean, did Charles Schulz have anything to do with those other than creating the characters and kind of signing away the rights? Did he write them, or I don't think he drew them?
Well, in fact, he did have something to do with it. He wrote A Charlie Brown Christmas. I'm not sure about all the other specials, but he wrote that script based on his own characters, of course. It was directed by Bill Melendez. And that's, of course, the one that, you know, just became a holiday mainstay. Peanuts were already hugely popular, but if anything, that pushed them into the stratosphere, you know, for the 70s, which were the salad days for peanuts and merchandising and all that.
Okay, I never thought I'd hear peanuts and salad days in the same sentence, but...
Eat your salad and then you can read your Peanuts comic strip. Yes, so there's a Peanuts film coming out. Who's putting it out?
20th Century Fox and Blue Sky Studios. Blue Sky... Did I hurt your ears in some way?
Well, Blue Sky, the people who do Ice Age.
Yes, that's
which
right.
Which is a film that nobody likes.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
A film series that's... Blah.
Well, my kids love Ice Age.
God bless them. It's not, they're not known for their quality films yet. They've made money.
Yes.
But they have, Blue Sky has not produced a great film yet. So, and you want somebody with a sensitivity to Charles Schulz and Peanuts. And Charles Schulz and Peanuts are thoughtful, low-key, subtle, humanistic. And Blue Sky is all about, like, at best, you know, Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote is their sort of thing. If they were adapting Wile E. Coyote, I would say, okay, that makes sense.
Well, wait a second. Wile E. Coyote is a Looney Tunes, isn't it?
Yes, it's Warner Brothers. I know. I'm not saying that they're going to, but I'm saying that sensibility matches them, whereas Peanuts does not.
Okay. Well, what are you saying about Looney Tunes?
I love Looney Tunes, but at least the sensibility matches.
Okay. Well, do you think that maybe...
You don't want the Three Stooges to adapt Shakespeare. You want the Three Stooges to adapt, you know, a Molière farce, I guess.
Well, I'm sure that there are plenty of people that would disagree and say, hey, it would be interesting to see their take on a, you know, Shakespearean farce. But do you think that the inclusion or the participation of Charles Schulz's son and grandson as, you know, writers in this film will actually help it along?
Well, that's certainly, I don't know if that was what they had to do to woo the family. They spent 2 years getting the rights to this. Obviously, it's an incredibly valuable property. The son of Charles Schulz and his grandson are co-writers of the script along with a third writer. So that's certainly a good sign. One hopes that the sensibility of the strips is something that they are trying to recreate. I don't know what talent they have. I'm not trying to be mean, but, you know, just because your father is incredibly talented doesn't mean you are. But clearly, if they're involved in writing the script, that tends to indicate maybe they're going to be doing it in the right spirit. So we can only cross our fingers and hope for the best.
Well, it's not always easy to keep creators happy. And certainly in the case of Charles Schulz's Peanuts, it's not Charles Schulz himself that needs to sign off on anything or that will be writing anything. But in the case of Marvel and Stan Lee, Stan Lee Media is suing Disney and Marvel is suing Stan Lee. I mean, I don't even know what's going on here. I just know that Stan Lee's name keeps coming up along with the word lawsuit.
Well, Stan Lee had a falling out with Marvel in the late 90s, and he also saw the dot-com boom and thought there was all sorts of opportunities to be had for comic books online. So he formed a new company called Stan Lee Media and sort of signed over rights to them. But then he had a falling out with them, Stan Lee Media, so he sued them and they sued him and everybody sued Marvel, and they came to a settlement. Now, ever since then, Stanley Media, which went bankrupt, I think, around 2001 after the dot-com boom busted, they exist primarily, it seems, to sue everybody. They sue Stan Lee and his family, they sue Marvel, and they sue any studio that makes a movie because they keep saying, hey, we'd like some of the profits. So now they're suing Disney because, of course, Disney made the Avengers, and Stanley Media is saying, hey, we'd sure like our share of the profits, roughly $750 million. Please write us a check.
And you know what? When you ask for a check for $750 million, I've found, and it's only been my experience, that people don't write it that quickly.
Well, it's a lot of zeros.
Yes. Maybe it's, you know, there's not enough room on the check.
Yeah, you need a bigger check.
Yes.
So they're all back in court again. Chances are we'll be tossed out again. But Stan Lee Media, which was a company formed by Stan Lee and later disavowed by Stan Lee, is, you know, hoping to get a cut of the profits and justify their existence.
And I guess Stan Lee at some point signed over rights to Marvel, and that case was settled because Stan Lee sued Marvel. And so every time Stan Lee Media goes back to court, the judges look and they say, hey, wait a second, this has already been decided. There's a settlement in this case already.
Right, exactly. And there is no settlement, however, in Superman, because if you create a comic book character, apparently all you ever do is sue people. Superman is back in the news because the heirs of one of the co-creators of Superman, that's Laura Siegel Larson, she's the daughter of Superman co-creator Jerry Siegel, and Joanne Siegel, who was the original model for Lois Lane. Jerry Siegel drafted Lois Lane based on the looks of his wife, God bless him, isn't that sweet? Well, she's been fighting with Warner Brothers for years, and nothing new has happened. They're back in court. She's won some settlements, but she released a long letter bitterly ripping into Warner Brothers and how they've screwed over her family and how her mother had to fight them until her dying days at 93 years old and just had to pass away without knowing final justice. And now she's going to keep on battling Warner Brothers.
Did she pass away?
The rights.
Did she pass away? I don't know if she did.
The mother did, Joanne Siegel. Yes, okay. She died last year.
Okay. My mistake.
So Laura Siegel Larsen is still plugging away, still doesn't like Warner Brothers, and she wants everyone to know it.
Well, and this is all about, this is a copyright issue. I mean, effectively, Jerry Siegel was asking for his copyright back, and by asking for the copyright back, apparently it was supposed to revert back to him, and Warner Brothers is saying, oh, we don't know anything. Anyway, let's go make another Superman movie.
Yeah, the copyright law is called the Mickey Mouse Law, not because it's a joke, but because Disney keeps pushing to have copyright extended so that Mickey Mouse never goes into the public domain.
That's
Mickey
right.
Mickey Mouse should have been in the public domain decades ago.
Which means that literally any company that wanted to put Mickey Mouse on a blanket or on a watch or on anything could do so without legally licensing it from Disney.
Right, though Disney could obviously still have a good business in official authorized merchandise with a little hologram or sticker saying this is the real deal. But obviously they don't want that competition, but tough. At some point, things have to go into the public domain. It's bad for business. It's bad for the country. It's bad for the arts when you keep extending copyright. And all of this is related to that. Superman was created, 70 years ago. It should have been in the public domain by now, but it's not.
Well, if it's in the public domain, then Laura Siegel Larsen would have no claim to it.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So that's.
But at some point, there's also a reverting of copyright. At a certain point, as we talked in music, it reverts back to the creator. Like when you give it away, at some point, you get to reclaim it again. That's what she did successfully in 2008 at a certain level of the court system. And that's why they're still battling it out in court. She reclaimed the copyright. And of course, Warner Brothers turned around and sued again to extend that battle.
That's right. Yeah. And so this is really, and all civil lawsuits here in the U.S. really are. It's a battle of lawyers and finances. The people with the more money and better lawyers win. That's most of the time.
That's truth, justice, and the American way.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately. Now, speaking of the American way or money and lawsuits and copyright, you see how I'm like bundling all of that together to talk about Pandora and digital radio and what Pandora, which is, I mean, how would you describe it? It's a streaming music service. You can't pick the song you want to hear, but you can pick the artist or the type of music. You could say jazz or classic jazz or classical.
I love Kenny G. Play me music like that.
Exactly. And then it plays an entire radio station based on, algorithm and people who they've hired to say, well, this Kenny G song is like this other song by Nicholas Payton. And they stream all this music to you, and you can listen to 30 hours, in a month, I think. Or I don't know how long you can listen to it, but they are paying something like 60% of all of the revenue to artists. And they're saying, hey, that's way too much. Our licensing fees, our royalties are way too much, and we need to go to Congress to stop this.
And so to make this case, they've released some figures on the actual money they're paying out to artists. And so they had a sort of a blog post where they said, hey, about 2,000 artists received $10,000 or more from Pandora over a 12-month period.
That's right.
800 artists, which is a lot more artists than are on the top Billboard 200. And of course, if you really want to make money in music, you got to break into the top 200. That's the general rule of thumb. You got to have a big hit album. 800 artists have received $50,000 or more. And then they have a few big names that have even received $1 million or more over a 12-month period. And a couple acts, two basically, Drake and Lil Wayne, who are approaching $3 million in annual rates.
Which means that their songs are coming up more and more in Pandora playlists.
That's right. So you'll see names like Coldplay and Adele and Jason Aldean, the country artist. They're all in the $1 million club. But then there are some acts that not everyone is familiar with, like a gospel singer, Donnie McClurkin. He made over $100,000 in a 12-month period.
Donnie McClurkin, you said?
Donnie McClurkin?
Yeah, okay.
There's a Mexican group, Grupo Brindis. They made about $114,000 over a 12-month period. So Pandora is saying, hey, look at all this great money we're handing out to artists. Aren't we wonderful?
Well, and then you look at Mumford & Sons, and they made $500,000 over the last 12 months, from Pandora.
Right. That's not a huge amount of money.
No, well, and when you think about it.
In terms of blockbuster albums, but it's good from one source. Again, Pandora is a national company, but they're saying, hey, we're not all of radio. We're just one company.
That's right. And you can't get Pandora overseas because, of course, music is licensed per country.
So their argument is twofold. It's a little contradictory. On the one hand, they say, isn't this great? Internet radio is wonderful. Look at all the money we're sending out to artists. On the other hand, they say, isn't this horrible? Look at all the money we're sending out to artists.
That's right. And I can't remember the name of the legislation they're trying to push through Congress, but I think it's the Internet Radio Fairness.
It's a rate that sets how much royalties they have to pay to the artists.
Right. And they want this to be standardized. They look at SiriusXM, the satellite radio provider here in North America, and they say, look, you know, they're paying only 8% of their revenue and we're paying 61%. Whereas others say, look, you know, Pandora, if you made more money, if you, you know, had more commercials
ads or higher subscription prices,
yeah, then it would be a lower percentage of your revenue.
What you were referring to is the fact that different delivery systems pay a different rate.
If that's
you're
right.
A terrestrial radio station in a local market, you don't pay the same rate as satellite radio, which reaches the entire country. Pandora, being an internet company, has a different rate from them. So everybody has, if you're cable radio, you pay a different rate. So depending on your market and how you deliver the music and how much of the country you reach, you pay a different royalty rate. And they say ours is too high. And they distort that by saying, look how much of our total revenue is going to pay the artists. And other people say, well, that's because you refuse to put on ads on your service because you know that'll drive away listeners and send them back to terrestrial radio or satellite radio or something else. You don't have enough ads. You don't charge enough money. If you did, the total percentage of your revenue they hand out to artists would be lower.
That's true. Yeah, and I like what Eric Gardner kind of said. He's over at, I can't remember the name of, what is it, the Hollywood Reporter Esquire blog? Is that the name of his blog?
Who is it? Ars Techno, wasn't he?
No. This is, you know, Eric Gardner. He's with the Hollywood Reporter.
Oh, yes.
And he kind of pointed out, look, Pandora is a public company, and the largest shareholder, or one of the largest shareholders in Pandora, is Tim Westergren, its CEO. And if this law passes, the analysts say that the stock price would double. And Westergren stands to earn $20 million from that kind of transaction.
I don't get this complaint. Well, duh, the guy owns the company, and if it does better, he'll make more money. So what? That doesn't make his argument invalid. Ted Turner made a ton of money from CNN. The fact that he might argue for legislation that benefits CNN is not a plot for him to make money. He wants to build a successful company. Of course he wants to make more money.
Yeah, and they're saying if it doesn't pass, the stock price will crumble. And I guess Gardner's point is, hey, if you're going to, you know, argue for this, then at least say, oh, and by the way, I stand to gain myself.
That's not a secret.
Well, I suppose. Yeah.
That's ridiculous. He's the owner of the company, or he owns a big chunk of the company, right?
Yeah. Oh,
is
absolutely.
He pretending he doesn't own 2 million shares of Pandora?
I don't think so.
Didn't he found it?
Yes, he did. And you know, it was founded.
So it's like thinking, what, Ted Turner will benefit if Time Warner? You know, it's like, it's not a secret.
You know, he's played his cards, and this is Tim Westergren, very smart, because the company was founded as the Music Genome Project, and it was a way to kind of figure out different how different music was similar and categorizing different types of music so that you could build an algorithm and editorial content around it. And he's used all that goodwill to help push certain political agendas. It worked once before, and he's trying to do it again, this time officially with with legislation.
Well, they've made arguments pro and con and this and that. One of their other arguments that I don't think holds weight is where they say, look at us, we're the last man standing, internet radio, we want to make this happen. But you look at the original three who tried to do this, AOL, Yahoo, Launchcast, and MSN, they all fled the business because your rate hike is too high. You know, it isn't going to work. We're not going to be able to survive if you don't lower our rates. But in fact, that ignores the fact that they have competition from Spotify and Rhapsody and Radio and Moog. So it's not that it can't work. It's that there are a lot of people out there doing it, and they just want a better rate.
Yeah, and I would also say that all of those services that you mentioned, Launchcast, MSN, those were all trying to start off at a time when there was a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace as to how streaming music was going to work, who was going to get paid, who whether you were stealing the music or not. And so a lot of those companies just said, you know what, this is way too complicated, we're out. And so I think that's kind of overlooking quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to this question, but let me ask you. Is their rate, royalty rate, whatever they're paying, is it too high? And not obviously as a part of their revenue, but just on its own, are they paying a higher penalty than, say, satellite radio than they should be?
I couldn't answer that without more information. I'd have to see how much satellite radio pays per play and how much Pandora is paying per play per listener.
But what we do know is that their argument doesn't hold a lot of weight, the one that they've made publicly.
Well, it's definitely on shaky ground. It's definitely a little questionable. And, you know, I was just saying about, you know, all of those other services like Launchcast, you know, at the time that those started, they, you know, a group like SoundScan, I don't know if it was around.
What does SoundScan have to do with it?
Well, SoundScan collects all of the money going to all the artists and the artists' labels. You know, all this money that they're talking about. So $3 million to Drake and Lil Wayne and $1 million to Coldplay and Adele. All of this money gets paid to these collection agencies like SoundScan. It then gets filtered through SoundScan, goes to the record labels. And by the time it gets to the artists, a lot of these artists are complaining, hey, yeah, I didn't really actually see any of that money, or I saw a small little check for 15 cents.
I don't know what service charges or whatever they're doing. I mean, that's, you know, there's ASCAP and BMI and all sorts of groups that take in money and then pay them out to artists. I don't know what their overhead structure is, but that sounds like a different issue than your issues with SoundScan or your record label, not with them.
It absolutely is. But it makes it harder for a working musician to make money. Now, those are very interesting words, working musician.
SoundScan began in 1991, I believe.
Ooh, I'm wrong then. I guess they were around.
Yes. But, and of course, none of it matters if you don't have musicians creating music.
That's right. And that's, I was trying to segue us into this story that was in Ars Technica and was written by Matthew Lazar. And he asks, have we lost 41% of our musicians? And he says it depends on how you count. And he's really referencing Carrie Sherman, the CEO of the Recording Industry Association of America, otherwise known as the RIAA. I guess back in June of this year, he gave a speech and it received, you know, some press because of all of the piracy stuff he spoke about. But he then mentioned that we've lost, since 1999 to 2011, we've lost 41% of our musicians.
And that, what he's saying is that according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, data that's put out by the federal government, the number of people who say, I am a musician, has declined from that year to this year, from 1999 to 2011 or 10. So that's about 12 years.
Right.
Now, of course, 2011 is the peak period of the worst recession in 80 years. So it's not surprising, perhaps, that a lot of people who might have been musicians said, yeah, I'm working in a restaurant.
Right.
Because they weren't making any money as a musician. It doesn't mean there isn't an issue going on, but I don't know if those particular years are a good comparison, given what was going on economically and how musicians are probably always having second jobs or whatever until they break through. So, you know, a working musician making a living as a musician, never easy, but certainly never harder than in 2011.
Well, Matthew Lazar says, look, you know, obviously musicians are hurting. A lot of people say during the last decade, there are fewer musicians, but is it 41%? So he did all of these, you know, looked up all these statistics and all these figures. And he says, you know, in the end, there's just too much conflicting data to actually produce a real simple percentage drop. Is it a drop? Sure. Is it 41%? Probably not. Is it 3%? No, it's probably a little more than that. But
well,
nobody can say for sure.
Well, we know the record sales have collapsed.
Right.
You know,
that's,
so
that's true.
You know, record labels have disappeared. You know, there's a lot of smaller labels, but making a living off of your, you know, indie label is not so easy. So you've got your big record labels down to three, is it?
Yes.
You've got record sales collapsing. You've got 41% fewer people saying, I am a musician. That's my job.
According to some people, but yeah.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Right.
So chances are they're hurting.
Right. Exactly. And I think
it's a big deal.
Ooh, okay. That's where I was headed. I was going to say, you know, effectively, Matthew Lazar over at Ars Technica was wondering whether this 41% was a big deal or whether it was, you know, something to care about. And he spent 2,000 words explaining that it was kind of a big whoop, which means it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the stand-up comic writer, actor, director, multi-hyphenate and Emmy winner Louis C.K. is taking a break from himself. He's asked FX to delay the new season of his sitcom until May of 2014 so he can catch his creative breath and plan out a new season, a new direction, and maybe not write, direct, star, and edit his own show all at the same time. This means the show will no longer be paired with Wilfred, starring Frodo Baggins, I mean Elijah Wood, but FX promises to find another partner for the half-hour show. Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael?
Well, that's a big whoop. I mean, he's pulling the Sopranos. He's saying, I need more time. Don't rush me. I'm an artist. But it's a good sign. You know, it's a good sign that you've got somebody creative and talented and they're willing to let you take off 8 months, 11 months, 14 months. It's what the UK has been doing for decades. And it's a reason why some of the shows are of such high quality. When you don't have to churn out 30 episodes and do it for 7 years in a row, guess what? You can do a better job at it. So it's good to see FX is smart enough to know that fans of Louis C.K. will be there ready for him when he's ready to return to television.
Is that what they call it now? Pulling a Sopranos?
That's what I call it.
See, I would have thought that shooting your mortal enemy and burying him in the Jersey swampland was pulling a Soprano.
That too.
Okay. Well, in a major ruling, a federal judge has tossed out an Authors Guild lawsuit against, how do you pronounce this? Is it Hathi Trust?
I think it's Hathi, but I don't
know. Hathi Trust. This is the digital collective established by libraries that was based on millions of scans created by Google. The judge ruled against every element of the case and said while the technology may be new, it was impossible for him to conceive how such scanning could not be an example of fair use. Scanning the entire work was transformative, the judge said, i.e. it's not just stealing. And that was because it allowed for full text searches useful for scholars and artists and made the text available to the blind and print disabled. I had no idea there were people among us who are print disabled. That's an interesting phrase. This ruling may be a fatal blow to the Authors Guild case against Google. So is it a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I think ultimately the law should come down in a lot of ways to common sense. And when you look at what they were doing, which was to scan books and allow people to search for phrases in them, and they would call up, you know, a phrase or a sentence or a few phrases, you know, that's seemed to me like, how could that not be fair use? That's crazy to say. There's no way that you would use that in order to read an entire book. So the idea that it wasn't fair use seemed puzzling to me, though obviously I'm not a lawyer. But the judge ruled that we were right, that it is fair use. It's pretty clear fair use. He said it's not even a question that it's fair use. So it's great to see. And he was very much won over by the arguments about how this expanded access to the blind and to other people. Someone who is print disabled, by the way, is someone who can't effectively read because of a visual, physical, perceptual, developmental, cognitive, or learning disability. So it can be somebody, you know, with an illness that gives them, you get dizzy if you try to look at a page for too long. The author Laura Hillenbrand suffers from an illness, it's not an illness, but a disability that makes her have to lie back down if she looks at a printed page for too long. She gets vertigo, she gets nauseous, makes it very hard for her to read documents and stuff. So having something, being able to have it read out to you if a book is scanned, is a very useful thing for her. So, you know, there's a lot of people who have an issue. Obviously, it comes down to even people who are illiterate, I guess. But there are a lot of reasons why you might be called print disabled.
Dyslexia, I would imagine, is one of them.
Well, people with dyslexia can learn to read. Obviously, you can't cure dyslexia, but you can help improve people on how they deal with it. But I'm sure it's a challenge as well.
I suppose I was just thrown by. I've never seen that phrase print disabled before.
Nah, neither have I.
Well, this next story is about apparently me. Hey, Grandpa, you still watch TV shows? How cute. That's the fear of the major networks, which are seeing the average age for primetime TV getting older and older and older. Oh, and the audience is also getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So older and smaller is not exactly what you want. Three of the big four networks have seen audience declines of almost 20% in the key 18 to 49-year-old demographics. NBC is really the only network to show some growth, and that's mostly because, let's face it, it was so far down in the basement, the only way to go was up. And really, it's all due to The Voice. Fox's audience is a median of 43 years old. Hey, wait a second. That's around my age, for Pete's sake. NBC is almost 48 years old, ABC is 55, and CBS is 57. These are the median ages. Who wants to bet that networks will start downplaying the 18 to 49 demo? Hey, 60 really is the new 40 anyway, now that their audience is getting grayer. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. First of all, I've always argued against focusing on the demographic. I always thought it was silly. Even as, like you, I get closer and closer to slipping out of the 49 demo, then I'll really be arguing for it. So, you know, we've got a vested interest in that, I guess. Don't feel bad, Sperling, because you're part of Fox. So you're part of the youngest age group watching, you know. If you watch Fox, you're part of the kids. You know, that's the youngest age for any primetime network. 43 is the median age on Fox. But I wonder if whether television viewing overall is getting older and smaller, because you're not counting Netflix and Hulu, online rebroadcasts, 7 day plus DVR watching, DVDs, etc. Is the audience really getting older? The country's getting a little older, so it's only natural. But I think all that new technology means younger viewers are simply consuming TV shows differently. And frankly, 60 really is the new 40 anyway.
You know, I've actually talked to some people who are in their 40s who were telling me how great like the Mindy Project was, and that they had, you know, just seen all three episodes. And I thought, well, did you, you know, DVR them, or how did you see all three episodes at once? Oh, Hulu.
Uh-huh.
So I agree with you. I think people are consuming television in different ways, and it's not necessarily on their television.
There you go.
Speaking of consuming things in different ways, ebooks surpassed hardcover sales for the first 6 months of 2012. In sales announced by the Association of American Publishers, which they represent more than 1,000 companies, including the big six publishers, ebook sales exploded 34% to $621 million in books geared toward adults. Now, hold on to your hat, Michael. There's going to be some numbers coming at you here.
All right.
Okay, so that figure, $621 million, blows past hardcover, whose sales are, you know, really increased 2% to $556 million. Trade paperback remained on top with an increase of 5% to $720 million. Mass market paperbacks, Michael, we know that is your favorite format, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. It's down 20% to $200 million. And children's books, hardcover remained king, presumably because it's harder for kids to chew on a Kindle. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. We've seen before that Amazon announced, hey, ebooks have passed. We've sold more ebooks in this 6 month period or 12 month period than we did of hardcovers or paperbacks. It's our number one format. But they're Amazon. They sell the Kindle. You'd expect that. Now we have figures saying overall for the entire industry, we sold more ebooks. We've made more money selling ebooks than hardcovers for the first 6 months of 2012. That's a sea change. That's unbelievable. And if they keep growing at this rate, they're going to pass trade paperback and become the dominant format in the publishing industry in the blink of an eye. It's, you know, this has moved at meteoric pace. So it's fascinating to see. Sure, some of it's driven by just a few big titles like 50 Shades of Grey and The Hunger Games. Publishing has become a blockbuster industry, just like Hollywood was in the 80s and 90s and today. That's not healthy. You want to see more sales across the platform. I'd love to find out if ebook sales are spreading out to catalog titles, whether we're seeing more catalog titles in ebook or whether it's strictly related to new titles and hot new releases. And I'd love to know whether, you know, 80% of The Hunger Games were sold in ebook or 50 Shades of Grey, or whether, you know, it's more balanced. I would imagine the big new titles are dominating in ebook, and that you'd find out that hardcover sales for older titles are a little bit stronger.
Well, let me ask you this. If the ebook sales have spread out to catalog titles, does that mean I will get fewer catalogs mailed to me by L.L. Bean and Banana Republic in the mail?
By catalog titles, I mean older books that are not new releases. So if you're buying a new copy of, say, John Grisham's The Firm, or a Charles Dickens novel, or a John Irving book that it didn't just come out this year, but maybe The World According to Garp, that's what I mean by a catalog title. That's used to be the mainstay of the industry. That's where they made their bread and butter. The new books, you know, most of them fail. A few blockbusters break through, and they made their money off their backlog of titles from great artists that they developed over the years.
Okay, so I'm going to take that as a no. CNN has produced documentary films before, such as its acclaimed Look at the Cold War, but now the news channel is launching a dedicated film unit, not just to produce its own programming, but to reach out and acquire documentary films made by others to air on its own channel. Example number one, Girl Rising, a documentary film about how hard it is for girls to get an education compared to boys around the world, directed by Academy Award nominee Richard Robbins. The film will air in the spring of 2013 and be supported by all sorts of features and specials around the topic of women and education on its regular programming. CNN is also exploring the possibility of nonfiction programming, aka, by the way, nonfiction programming. These days, it means reality TV. Big deal.
Honey Boo Boo.
Honey Boo Boo. That's right. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it seems like a big whoop to me. I mean, they've been making documentaries for years. Now they're just saying, hey, we should be acquiring documentaries. Well, that seems to be the big argument that they're making. We should bring in if we see a good documentary film on the festival circuit, we should acquire it and show it on CNN. Well, okay.
So let me get this straight. CNN, you are there to provide news. Now you're going to be providing news in another format. Interesting.
Well, they obviously, for breaking news, they would obviously interrupt any show that they were doing, whether it's Piers Morgan or a documentary film or anything. They can always break in and say, we got to go, we got breaking news. Their argument is, look, with the 24-hour news cycle, with so many channels, with the internet, you don't turn on CNN to find out the latest news. You've got it in a million different ways. They used to be on the cutting edge. You would always turn to CNN for the news because they were the only ones telling it to you. You didn't have to wait till 6:30 to watch it when the networks came on with Peter Jennings and whoever it might be. Now you're on the internet. So they say, well, it's 8 o'clock at night. People know the news of the day. Nothing new is happening. If there's no breaking news, why are they coming to our network? No one's tuning in to see Piers Morgan. So now they're saying, maybe we should fill our primetime with more original programming like this documentary film, and we can build it into our network, make it part of our brand, you know, expand the discussion of education and women by doing segments and features and stories on all our different programs, bringing guests, and make it a discussion, a town hall meeting about, if you like, the topic at hand.
So in a way, they are embracing change and saying, we have to change what we're doing, which I think we'll be talking a little bit more about.
Well, when you're number three or four in the market, I guess.
I guess you kind of
eventually you wake up.
Yeah. Well, speaking of change, France has some of the, well, make that the most restrictive regulations when it comes to movies. The art form France invented, by the way, and takes huge pride in as a national symbol of greatness. Their rules extend to allowing authors to film their own novels and all sorts of restrictions on what can be shown when on TV, DVD, satellite, and so on. This includes subscription video on demand, or as it's known in the biz or here on Showbiz Sandbox, SVOD, which, you know, it's blocked in France for a huge 3 years after a film's release. But international companies aren't always bound by these local rules, and Amazon, guess who, is about to throw the French film market into a tizzy by launching an SVOD service a la Netflix in France next March. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
The big deal in France.
That's true.
You know, Netflix is coming to France. It's going to eventually. They can't keep movies off of SVOD for 3 years. It's just, they think it's best for their country and the industry as a whole. But when they can't stop a foreign company from coming in and doing it, if that's not possible to stop, obviously all the locals are going to want to do it as well. So change is going to come whether they like it or not.
Yeah, and I think the BBC is seeing that too, because they're going to be, you know, joining Ultraviolet, at least with four of its titles. And Ultraviolet is that way that you can, like, own a DVD, but then also store it online in an online locker.
And you can access a digital copy.
Right, correct. And what I think is interesting about the Amazon news is that it was announced, or it was discovered, because the head of Canal Plus kind of told a hearing, you know, at French Council of State, that online retailer Amazon is planning to launch a subscription video on demand service in March of 2013. I guess that was a big kind of oops. Has he heard of NDAs? You're not really supposed to do that, you know, in public.
Whoopsie.
Well, this next story, Michael, it's really for you. Come December, you will be able to buy your movie ticket to see The Hobbit with genuine Middle Earth currency.
Mithril? Is it made of mithril?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, sadly, I do.
Yeah, well, listen, it's actually New Zealand currency. But that country, where the films are made and tourists flock to see location sites, is putting out coins with Bilbo Baggins, Gandalf. Of course, he's known as Gandalf the Grey to those.
Or Gandalf the White, depending.
I guess which wig he's wearing. I don't know. Gollum and other characters will be on their faces, you know, on the face of the coin. The coins are legal tender, but are essentially collectible, since a New Zealand $1 coin will cost about $25 US. And they're making ones all the way up to a pure gold New Zealand $10 coin that will cost about $3,000. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, obviously. It's just a collectible coin, but it's amusing. If we were charging for Showbiz Sandbox, we would demand payment in Bilbo Baggins dollars.
In Bilbo. Now let me ask you this. Does Elijah Wood get a cut?
I'm almost certain he doesn't.
No, I guess it wouldn't be Elijah Wood, since he played Frodo Baggins.
That's true. I'm sure Frodo will be on a coin as well. Whether they'll use the likeness from the films or the likeness from, I imagine they'll use likeness from original Tolkien illustrations. That's a good question, actually. But what likenesses they will use, what illustrator? There are classic illustrators who have adapted them for calendars and book covers throughout the years, some quite well known among fantasy, you know, aficionados. So whether they're going to use the movie image faces or that one. If it's a movie image face, then I imagine they will get a cut of some sort.
Or at the very least,
if they have the rights to it, you know.
Yeah. Well, and they're also making stamps in New Zealand. So
now I think they did the stamps before, though.
Oh, they did. Okay. And did you collect them then?
No.
Okay.
I'm only semi-dorky.
Okay. But not when it comes to the mail.
That's right. I send email.
Exactly. I wonder if email stamps. Anyway. That concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're going to be discussing some news which it's really the definition of Inside Baseball. You see, last week, Variety, which is an entertainment industry institution and has been reporting on the trade for more than 100 years, it was sold to Penske Media Company, the group that owns Deadline Hollywood, Hollywood Life, Movie Line, and others. The price tag was a shockingly low $25 million. Here to discuss the acquisition news of Variety is Dana Harris, the editor-in-chief of IndieWire, who previously spent 11 years at the publication working alongside the likes of Peter Bart, the publication's famed editor, Mike Fleming, Todd McCarthy, the film critic, and Ann Thompson, who is now over at IndieWire at the Thompson on Hollywood blog. Dana, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, you wrote a very interesting editorial, I thought, about what happened to Variety and why it happened. And, you know, it was a world-renowned trade publication with name brand recognition, and somehow its value not only financially but also within the industry just plummeted over time. Why do you think that is?
Well, it was, on a really basic level, it's about market timing. There was a point not that long ago, really just a few years ago, where they could have sold it for as much as, $300 million or even a little bit more. At that point, though, they were still hoping, I think, that they could somehow make the old days come back. There was a long, long time there when Variety was not only the dominant force in Hollywood coverage, it was also dominant force in terms of revenue. It was just like it made such great money for its owners for a long time, and then it didn't. And I don't think anybody was prepared to face that. It was kind of a set of happy circumstances in the first place that it did that well, and then on top of that, when you deal with the nature of what happened with online publishing, It just was not going to face reality. And the result was, the deterioration of the value.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, Variety some time ago put up a digital paywall. So you had to actually log in and you had to be a subscriber. And I think they had 17,000 readers at Variety.com, whereas The Hollywood Reporter had something like 5.1 million. And I know IndieWire is way up there as well.
Sure, yeah.
Do you think that putting up that digital paywall, to me, it just took them out of the conversation?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the paywall was silly. I mean, it's just like, but you have to kind of look at what the real reason for the paywall was, because I believe that there was a fantasy, if you will, that the paywall would be a moneymaker. I don't think paywalls work, period, for Variety or anybody else. I just don't think they make sense. But the other reason for the paywall, though, was to preserve the print. They wanted to do whatever they could to preserve the print value, and that meant making the digital less accessible. And because the print value was where all the ad money was coming from, with all the specials and with the awards ads and things like that, and there is absolutely no way to get an equivalent amount of money out of the digital advertising. For any publication, it just doesn't work. And they were not going to give that up. So that was really the pay. That was, in a way, the paywall did what it was supposed to do. It was supposed to make the print continue to be viable. It wasn't about making it a viable property overall, because it was sort of, there's also kind of you're protecting one thing, but you're destroying something else. It was a short-term play.
The paywall wasn't their only mistake, though. What else did they do wrong? They didn't seem to embrace video. They didn't seem to embrace the online attitude, as far as constantly reporting on the business and updating and blogs and all that sort of stuff that you have to do to survive and flourish these days.
Right, exactly. I think that's absolutely true. They were not a digital publication. They did not want to be a digital publication. It was all about trying to maintain the money they had and keep the costs as low as they could. And the thing is, print's expensive too. Now that digital's cheap, because it's not. But you know, maintaining and publishing print, you know, all that paper, all those presses, I mean, that's expensive stuff. And that was the deal they made. And so the upshot was, is they looked kind of silly. They took themselves out of the conversation. They became, you know, sort of, like I think I said in the article, frozen in amber. They just stopped.
Right, right. You say that they believed in their own publicity and their own dominance.
Yes. Oh, and they absolutely did. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like that. And, you know, it's like working at Variety, there's like, you know, it's a little bit inevitable. It's like, you know, how many times have we seen Variety, you know, shown off in TV shows and movies, and it's shorthand for the industry. And, you know, my uncle thinks I'm the coolest person in the world because I worked at Variety. And, but at the same time, it's like, really, though, that's not the way it is. That's not what's happening. That's no longer the way of the world. But it takes, you know, there's an awful lot of movies and there's an awful lot of TV shows that, you know, said otherwise. And it's easy. It was easy to believe for a long time.
Well, you know, you said internally there was a lot of talk about change at Variety and a lot of talk about how people didn't give Variety its, you know, its due and credit for having changed. But, you know, you say, I like what you had to say here. You wrote, if those are common topics of conversation, it's all but assured that you aren't even close to change.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons I felt this, I had this perspective was because when I was at Variety for like the last year or so, I was also enrolled in something called the Founder Institute, which is a startup incubator. And it was a totally separate project I was working on that had nothing to do with Variety. But it was the real reason I wanted to do the incubators because I wanted to understand as much as I could about the online world and online businesses. And so I got accepted into this program and I was hanging out with the VCs of Silicon Beach and, you know, we were getting, you know, these heavy duty lectures and just like no nonsense talk every single week. And I was looking at this going, oh my God, Variety doesn't have a clue. There's no way. And it's not because I'm an expert. I'm not. I'm a baby in this, but it's just so obvious that they really don't know what they're doing. And I don't think anybody cares. And they didn't. They absolutely didn't. That was one of the reasons why I was delighted to come to IndieWire.
Sperling said that the price for Variety was a shockingly low $25 million. I'm not sure if it's not shockingly high. Frankly, I'm not sure what you're buying at this day and age. There's still, I guess, goodwill in the name, but is it worth $25 million? Unless they own their office building, I'm not sure what you're buying.
You're just buying the brand name. Yeah, no, they definitely don't own the office building. They have, I think, a very expensive lease there. I wonder if they own the sign or if they rent that.
They have for those of you who have never been to Los Angeles, they have they're in a very tall building here that says Variety at the top of it in its logo. And it's kind of viewable from, well, all over Los Angeles, really.
Yeah. And it's, which is, you know, again, I mean, you know, there's, when they installed that sign, it was just such a, you know, again, it was just like such a statement to me of what the, you know, of what they were trying to do. It's like they were trying to declare themselves that we are, you know,
we're
dominate.
Still Variety.
And it's like, you can put up as many million-dollar signs as you want. It's not going to change the facts.
Well, they also own all that slanguage, like BAFO and, you know, all that language that they created to kind of...
Which drove me crazy when I was at Variety.com because, you know, I should say, make it really clear, I really enjoyed working at Variety. I really did. And I was very fortunate to get to do a lot of really cool things there, including running Variety.com and getting to cut my teeth in terms of understanding, you know, something about digital. But when I started to learn about SEO, I was like, oh no, this is not going to work. This language stuff has absolutely no currency in SEO. None. It's like putting, you know, a row of, you know, vowel-less consonants into your headlines.
Nobody Googles BAFO.
Right, exactly.
There's just, it's, you know, no one, you know, there's no ankled. It doesn't make any sense. And on a very practical level, that was a disaster. And then on kind of a philosophical level, it's a disaster as well, because it just, you know, the fact that they're so proud of this language is like, this is something that no longer carries any currency.
Well, now let me ask you, a lot of digital ink or practical, physical, and, you know, a lot of ink over the past week has been spilled over the fact that Nikki Fink, who did she not work at Variety at one time? I think she worked at both trade papers at one point, but she ran off. She started Deadline, Deadline.com, Deadline Hollywood, and it effectively is an online trade. It was initially considered a blog. I would agree with you, as you say in your editorial, nobody's really referred to Deadline as a blog in quite some time. It's breaking news now. And they say, well, look, you know, this proves that Nikki Fink won. Would you see this as a Nikki Fink victory, even though she's not really, it's her owners that are taking over?
Digital victory.
Oh, I'm sorry, go on.
It's a digital victory, online versus old school.
Exactly. And which is like, which on the one hand is sort of, you know, duh, you know, it's not a very, in a way that's kind of not a very exciting story because we all know that. The fact that it was, you know, that it's the company that owns Deadline that got it, obviously that's, you know, kind of the story of, I don't know, Greek tragedy or farce, depending on how you look at it. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's like, it really is though, it's about the digital. It's not about Nikki. It's about the fact that a digital company got this. I mean, there's obviously, there were other people that were interested in it. And, you know, I'll be very interested to see what they do with the Variety brand. I mean, you were asking earlier if the $25 million is shockingly high. And in a way, you know, it depends. I mean, it's like we're looking at this from, you know, the inside baseball perspective. You know, look at the people who own this Third Point, which is a, you know, a hedge fund that own, you know, that controls billions of dollars. $25 million is nothing to them. Underneath the couch, you know, there is not, that's nothing. So in term from that perspective, from the kind, and you know, from the brand value, I think it's all right it's the right buyer for that price.
Well, then what do you think Variety should do? What do you think will happen there? You say that you expect some layoffs and maybe some poaching of some leadership, you know, leadership or the vision might get overhauled. But what do you think is going to happen at Variety? Is it going to merge with Deadline?
I don't think it's going to merge with Deadline. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's just like, it's not at this point anyway. Maybe at some point if they, you know, if they're going to need to see what the market does before they would ever consider merging the brands. I mean, merging a brand is a very, very big deal in any case. And I think they need to see how the market reacts to it. I mean, I think obviously they need to grow their awards business. They need to grow their specials business because that's where the bulk of their money comes from, the bulk of their revenue. And that seems the most natural element to me is that you turn Variety into the kind of the fluffier outlet that competes with the Hollywood Reporter. That would be my first guess.
So you change by actually going back to the way it was in like the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Actually, it's a really good point. Kind of, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain degree anyway. I mean, obviously a lot has changed since then, but yes, given what Variety was at that time. Although, you know what? I mean, it's like, God knows, I spent a lot of time in the Variety archives because one of the digital projects that we did, again, sort of like, you know, got a lot of effort went into that and I'm not sure why. They, you know, the entire archives of Variety are digitized, like all 100 and some odd years. They are available for sale online.
Wow. Okay. It's amazing.
Huge project. It was one of those things, huge project that no one knows about. And so, I mean, so I spent a lot of time reading a lot of old varieties. And even in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was still pretty tradey. It was not, there was more fluff in terms of like there would be some hilarious things about the fact that, you know, they would announce that Mrs. Jimmy Stewart was flying from New York to Los Angeles. I mean, there like a little item at the bottom. So there's like little funny things like that in there. But I mean, there was more of a, you know, gossipy element, but there was still a lot of heavy duty trade content. You know, I do think the lines of demarcation will be stronger between Variety and Deadline in that respect. I can't see why in the world you would have two breaking news organizations at two different publications owned by the same person. That doesn't make any sense.
So Daily Variety goes away?
I would think it's a print publication. I would be shocked if it stayed. Shocked, shocked, shocked. It's too expensive and no point. I mean, it's just like at this point, the only reason you have a print version of Daily Variety, to my mind, is because it's nice to have something in the agents' waiting rooms.
And so I guess technically when Janice Min came into the Hollywood Reporter and did away with the Daily Hollywood Reporter, and everybody said, oh, this is sacrilegious, she was right.
Oh, she was. She was absolutely right. Yeah, she's a very, very, very smart lady. So this is a separate topic. I don't know, you know, I've been so impressed by what the Reporter has done. I have absolutely no idea what the profitability is because, God, those are some expensive photo shoots they do.
Oh, yes.
And that's some very expensive paper that, you know, all that stuff, even on a weekly basis. But yeah, so I mean, I think she was right. But it's like, but why? It's like, there's no way in the world the print edition is going to remain is going to be more relevant than something that can be published instantaneously. It just, I mean, on a, the most basic level, it's a delivery system, you know, it, like everything else in the world of, you know, communication. It's like, you know, it's like warning the Pony Express.
So there are big changes in store for Variety, and because you have to change if you want to survive. And if people go to IndieWire.com, they can see where you have brought in bloggers and reporters with strong followings like Ann Thompson of Thompson on Hollywood. You have a video interview with Ben Affleck, the director of Argo. You have a short film that you host from the director of Uncle Boonmi, Apichapong Wera Sethakul.
Oh, I can't believe you even tried to pronounce that.
I tried
that.
To say that. I was a little rough. You have obviously breaking news stories and reporters, and you cover all the festivals. But I'm wondering, what are the next changes that you're making at IndieWire? We see you're doing the things that people need to do today, but what are you? How are you rethinking your business and what you need to do differently tomorrow in order to stay on top?
Well, we just launched a new product. Actually, we launched it at Lincoln Center as of Friday, Critic Wire. Which you'll, if you go to the homepage, it's on the nav, the little button that says new. We've had Critic Wire for a long time, but it's a much more robust product now that allows users to rate films in addition to the critics and to, but at the same time, it's about doing the critical conversation first. And we're trying to harness the power of, you know, aggregation and the internet while not, as we see, throwing out the baby with the bathwater, which happens with a lot of the film criticism sites. It's like, you know, things about, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down. And we kind of believe in the primacy of the critical voice. So that's what we're trying to do with Critic Wire, is trying to maintain the value of that voice while also making it easy to figure out what movies you should go see. And by the way, which indie movies you should go see, because that's what our business is.
So smarter than Rotten Tomatoes.
That is our hope.
No, a thinking man's or person's Rotten Tomatoes. That's interesting.
So we just launched that on Friday. Very excited about that. I'm really interested in following what the tech and digital world means for filmmakers. Obviously, we all know that, you know, there's, you know, all the equipment in the world is available now to filmmakers, but there's just so many other things that are developing all the time with, you know, like products like Tug or, you know, the crowdfunding movement. And I really want IndieWire to become a resource for that, because I just think that's going to continue growing. And DIY, you know, we're seeing it. DIY is the way for all filmmakers. I mean, David Fincher has a bloody crowdfunding campaign at this point.
Yes, for an animated film called The Goon. Yes.
So, I mean, it's just, I think that's going to be one of our next big areas to tackle.
Well, certainly. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us regarding the acquisition of Variety by Penske Media. Greatly appreciate your time. And where can people, besides IndieWire.com, they can probably follow you on Twitter.
My Twitter handle is The Knife.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Well, that was interesting. She clearly has affection for the publication. She worked there for many years. So, I mean, she is a competitor to what they are. So we should, you know, make that clear. We did reach out to Penske Media to see if they wanted to have someone come on the show and talk about their acquisition.
Along with Dana, we were going to have, we were going to have both of them on together to, you know, say, hey, here's what Dana said. And Penske, what do you have to say to that? But yeah, they're not really talking that much right now.
Well, they're trying to figure out what they're going to do with this, I guess. Obviously, it makes no sense to merge it with Deadline. Why would you pay $25 million for a name brand and then get rid of it?
Good point. But, you know, we know about name brands because we are one here at Showbiz Sandbox.
That's right.
But we got that name brand because of you, our listeners. And our listeners can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we urge you to subscribe in iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace or Stitcher or any podcast aggregator or RSS reader. We'd really appreciate it if you rated and reviewed the shows on those aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as all those ways to contact us and subscribe to us and even follow us. We're on Twitter. Our username is ShowbizSandbox. We have a Facebook page you can like. Guess what? Username and the page can be found at facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. All of that information, as well as links to all the stories we talked about today, can be found on ShowbizSandbox.com. That's our website, ShowbizSandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz, he can be found at Yankee Stadium. And when he's not there, he can be found, well, at least some of his writing can, on his own website and the Huffington Post. Michael, what is your website?
Shockingly, it's called michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Go Yankees!